Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe. This is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today is no exception. We have a great guest all the way from Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to the show, Dennis Cisterna.
Thanks so much for having me, Victor. Appreciate it.
Well, great to have you here. Now, Dennis, you've been at this game a while, first as an employee and then off on your own, and you've amassed a fairly sizable portfolio. I'm very excited to have this conversation because you're doing something that some might consider to be countercurrent. But before we dive into the details, maybe give a little bit of your backstory and how you got to this point in your journey.
Sure. I started my career out of college as a housing market analyst, worked my way up the corporate ladder, working for large development and investment companies such as Lennar, Toll Brothers, Cerberus Capital Management. Finally reached that exalted CEO position and realized I still was not really the boss. I had a board of directors. We had investors. It was a little more unfulfilling than what I had hoped for. And so in mid-2018, I struck out on my own, started a residential investment platform called Guardian Residential. And as most entrepreneurs go, once you get a taste of the bug, you just keep going. So I started another firm called Lafayette Communities, which is focused on build-to-rent communities in the U.S. And then in 2019, I started Sentinel Net Lease with a good friend of mine, and we focus on commercial real estate investment opportunities throughout the U.S.
If you look at the segments of the market that are experiencing the most distress today, certainly office is top of the list. Retail, at least some segments of retail, are not far behind it. And it's all, as soon as you say those words, that often just even shuts down a conversation. That's how emotional the reaction is in the current environment. And yet you're still seeing opportunities in some of those segments, which I think is right. But yet at the same time, in an environment when you have that much, I'll say, oversupply, it does change the market dynamics. How do you navigate your way through that? And where are you seeing the opportunities?
Yeah, well, I get very excited if people don't want to talk about something because that means they're just using conventional wisdom as their primary analytical tool. And I think if you're really looking to create value and find arbitrage in the market, it is looking at those distress points and kind of finding the needle in a haystack that makes sense. And that can be, you know, something as complex as buying notes or properties out of foreclosure. Or in my situation, you know, I look at opportunities in the office sector where I think because the market has cast the entire sector in such a bad light, they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. So whether you've got a great asset that is stabilized under a long-term lease to an investment-grade tenant, it's getting treated, you know, much more harshly than it should from a risk-adjusted return perspective. And so that's where we're seeing value is, you know, looking where office still has great utility, where people are actually coming into the office. And we tend to focus on single tenant deals as opposed to, larger multi-tenant buildings with hundreds of different companies in it. And so in doing that, it's also in suburban locations, which has not been impacted nearly as much as the urban centers throughout the U.S. have been. So in doing so, you know, we've got the depression in values that's already occurred. I mean, most assets that we're able to acquire today in the office side are 30 to 40% below peak value. That's in line with kind of great recession numbers for the assets hit hardest. There's probably a little bit of value further to fall, obviously, as we work our way through further distress. But what I'm acquiring, what our firm is acquiring, are stabilized 100% occupied buildings that are secured by leases that are 8, 10, 15 years long, and I'm able to acquire them at cap rates that are 9, 10, 11%, still borrow at 6.5 to 7, so produce a really strong cash-on-cash return compared to other asset classes right now. And I think if you look at most people's strategy right now, they're assuming that there's going to be some decline in interest rates over the next few years. Well, if that happens, every sector's cap rate compresses. And so my theory is I'm going to clip a coupon that is 2 to 3 times higher in most sectors and then still get the benefit of that cap rate compression in the future. And so if I sell at that point, great. I've probably generated a 15 to 25% net IRR with no construction or lease up risk. And if I don't, if that doesn't happen, then I'm still out earning the other asset classes on a cash on cash perspective and essentially guaranteeing a full return of my invested capital from the contractual lease income, assuming these companies don't default and they just continue to pay their rent.
When you look at the drivers for the changes that have taken place in office, whether it's in an urban setting or a suburban setting, the drivers are the same. When you look at a building, and let's say three of the floors are leased by a law firm, and they decide they're going to reconfigure their space, collapse down to two floors and sublet the third floor because they can gain efficiency, they've got rid of the walled offices and turned them into boardrooms and so on, do you view that, the value of that lease, through a different lens, or do you just say, they signed a 10-year lease, I don't care? How do you view it?
No, I think that's a very good point. And I think you've seen over the last 2 years, especially now that we've kind of moved past COVID, that these companies are right-sizing the office space they have. Knowing that, you know, this hybrid work schedule is not necessarily going away quickly, not because employers don't want to, it's because the employees have more leverage right now than ever because we have a labor shortage in the U.S. Now, if the economy slows down and AI starts to take jobs the way people talk about it, then the employees may not have as much leverage. But both of those scenarios also require less office space as well. So I think as you see these companies right size, what you want to be sure you're having is a building that if you do have that vacant space coming up, that it's going to be attractive to other tenants. I think you're seeing in general a flight to quality of high class B and class A office with amenities being treated much more favorably than the older office stock. And that's really kind of part of our thesis right now. To your point, there is way too much office in this country for this new paradigm of how much office is really needed. I think the counter argument to that is a lot of this office space, even if it's still technically unoccupied, it is functionally obsolete. There are millions of square feet of office out there that nobody's even trying to get a tenant into because the economics don't make sense. And I think as you see those buildings get knocked down, repurposed in some situations, and you see that ultimate supply start to constrain, then you'll see the office sector right-sized. And when it's right-sized, you want to be in those nice buildings in good locations. And that's really our focal point on what we're buying. We don't think that the office sector is going to be perfect in 3 or 4 or 5 years. We think it's probably a decade-long process. But step one of taking advantage of that shift is buying really the best buildings you can at a fraction of replacement cost to give yourself a defensive barrier against new competition and also give yourself an advantage in any potential lease-up scenarios should there be a sublease opportunity from your existing tenants.
So that sounds like a fairly effective hedge. Another hedge that I've heard of, and I don't know if you're practicing this or not, is looking at buildings where the floor plate at least has the potential for conversion. It's small enough that you could build apartments if you needed to. Most office buildings, you think about the Manhattan office building that's 200 by 200 floor plate, that's never going to be an apartment building ever because you got an acre under that floor. So, but if you have a, I don't know, 80 by 100 or 80 by 200 even, you have at least a shot of converting that building. Is that something that falls into your thought process?
It's certainly something we've assessed quite a bit because you can buy those buildings, those type of buildings where they are, you know, vacant, 100% vacant now or near to it. But it's hard to find buildings where that is the footprint where it's got that long kind of apartment-ish corridor. Most buildings are more square and that depth doesn't help anything in terms of the ultimate footprint you need for residential opportunities. And then two, you've got to be in a market where after those conversion costs, you can still rent it at a decent yield on cost. And I think that's where the biggest problem, other than really the largest and highest rent markets in the country, you know, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, LA and Miami, like it doesn't work. It could be in as many publications and as many news articles as people want to talk about, but I don't think that is ultimately a saving grace for a lot of this office, especially the older stuff where the building systems are kind of garbage to begin with. We've ran some numbers where we could be getting the building for free and it still doesn't pencil, because ultimately your conversion cost in most markets is somewhere between $170 and $220 a square foot. As you know, as a developer, why not just go build it yourself instead of go through all the headache of repurposing a building?
Yeah, by the time you've drilled 3,000 holes in the concrete slab for your plumbing, you're almost better off pouring a new slab.
That's right. That's right. I think in a lot of these scenarios, if you really look at if the value of this unoccupied building goes to zero because the re-tenanting cost of office is so high, the conversion costs don't work, it's really the residual land value. And so then you have to look at, okay, what is the land worth kind of per door for new multifamily construction or a hotel or, obviously industrial is very hot right now. And as long as you can be in an area where that zoning makes sense, I think you're seeing a lot more of that getting done. In fact, I split my time in Southern California as well. There was a great article the other day about a Class A office building, and they used the Class A part generously because it was built like in 1992, but it was in a very central area in Orange County in Southern California, and it was being raised for a new industrial. That makes a ton of sense because industrial demand in Southern California is through the roof. You're able to move that product, at a much lower cap rate than pretty much any asset class right now. So guys are willing to go ahead and knock those buildings down because they can get to a return they want on the development side of things, which, as you know, is pretty darn tough in this interest rate environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you talked a little bit about office. Where do you see the play in retail?
You know, on retail, I think there's some opportunities on big box deals where your basis is low enough. I think you've seen a good resurgence in retail overall. I think you also have a lot of distressed retailers out there, right? And those big boxes are included. But one thing I've learned over the last 25 years is new retailers pop up every 2 or 3 years. They expand aggressively and they take over the old spaces that the old other guy had. So, I think there's like 150 Dick's Sporting Goods that used to be Sports Authority, that used to be, Sportsman Warehouse or what some of the older brands. So I think it's getting into those properties at the right basis with the right amount of term remaining. That's interesting from the big box perspective. We like grocery stores. We think there's a lot of, we own a few of them. We also own a BJ's Wholesale Club, which is akin to Costco on the East Coast. We're able to buy those at attractive basis, have enough duration in it, and be able to put accretive debt on it where, we think those kind of businesses have had a great resurgence because of the combination of normal retail shopping combined with e-commerce and kind of the instant delivery. So, you look at a company like BJ's where they now offer the ability to pick up your order at the front door the way Target, some of the other retailers does. That's been a huge boon to the bottom line. And then when you factor in Instacart and kind of making these grocery stores a multimodal experience as a way to get their product out, it becomes a de facto distribution center for a lot of these folks. And so we like the multi-utility of those buildings and what they're doing. So you just have to be selective and understand the value, the sales that, in the grocery store world, they use in all of retail, they use a health ratio to look at what percentage of rent relates to the store sales. So with grocery stores, it's not a super high margin business to be a grocery store, but the rent is usually below 5% of the total revenue it generates. So it doesn't take a lot to stay in a location for a very long time. And I don't know about you, but I go to the area I grew up in and that grocery store is still standing, 45 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we're obviously seeing signs of weakness in the retail sector. Family Dollar announcing 1,000 store closures, part of a subsidiary now of Dollar Tree. Target making noises recently that they're seeing pocketbook fatigue or something. That's not an official term, obviously, but where their revenue is taking a hit. And they themselves are trying to get into that discount space, even at the same time that they're witnessing the entrenched players hemorrhaging. Right. How do you think that plays out?
Well, I view all kind of growth very similarly in that most developers and most businesses don't talk to one another to talk about how they're going to oversupply a market. And so this is actually the same thing that makes me a little bit nervous about industrial in secondary and tertiary markets. There's only so many million square feet warehouses that can go up in Paducah, Kentucky before you kind of reach saturation. And so I think you're seeing the same thing with a lot of retail brands where they are so growth focused and they want to open as many storefronts as possible. They're not really looking at the true demand. And with as much data as out there, you would think that it would be pretty easy to understand where I don't want to go. But still, I think that's really the biggest problem here is growing at all costs. And then now you see this pullback where, okay, you know what? We probably didn't need to open 700 stores last year. Wall Street loved it for us at first, but now we realize that we really can't sustain those year-over-year growth from a store opening standpoint or from a revenue standpoint, because a lot of those secondary and tertiary markets just do not have enough bodies to sustain a growth for those type of businesses. The other factor to consider is if you look at the personal savings rate in the U.S., it has started to go down again. And so as much money as was printed during COVID to increase the overall money supply, I think that helped buoy inflation as the Fed kept rates low and everybody had money. They were spending money on everything. And I think now you're seeing, oh, okay, I've run out of the COVID funds. Everything is a lot more expensive. My income hasn't actually gone up nearly as much as the cost of milk or anything else. I better settle down on my discretionary spending. And so I think that's why you're seeing this pullback from a lot of retailers where there's just not as much money to go around. And I think you're going to continue to see that trend even as the Fed reduces interest rates, because it's not going to be material enough to change the nominal change in values that has already occurred that impacts the average household.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you think about it, just because the Fed lowers interest rates, you're not going to all of a sudden take that extra flight on United, or you're not going to get a discount on your auto insurance or any of those other things that are unaffected by interest rates. So that's absolutely right. Tell us a little bit about your net lease fund. When we think about single asset purchases versus the fund model, there's pros and cons to both. Special purpose entities make sense. Investors can put their eyes on it, say, okay, I understand the thesis for this investment. But when you do a fund model, you often obscure that, and it makes it a little bit more difficult for investors to understand really what's in the fund. What are your thoughts? I mean, we've looked at both and we've done both. Yeah. What drove you to do a fund model at this point?
Well, you know, the first 20 acquisitions we did for Sentinel were all on a deal-by-deal basis. And our investors like the ability to pick and choose. There's no doubt that retail investors like the ability to get in and out of certain things or just be able to say no. And in the fund, obviously, you know, you're with us for everything. I think we did the fund for two reasons. One, I think we've got a very unique runway over the next 2 or 3 years, where we can buy properties at elevated cap rates with long duration. And because of that, I consider it to be a very thematic investment. So you may not know every investment I'm going to buy during the duration of the fund, but you can know they're going to adhere to a fairly tight principle of average lease term of 8+ years, cap rates of at least 8.5. Cash on cash is always going to exceed our preferred rate of return of 8 or 8.5. And we're always going to use accretive debt, right? Whatever I buy has to make sense today. And so that theme of the fund, I think, works for a lot of investors that understand there is a lot of power in operating a fund versus being a 1-by-1 syndicator. So luckily, we've got a great track record in the space as it is. But when you have a capital base of equity you're sitting on, and you've already got the lending relationship set up, you can go chase those institutional caliber assets and be able to close on them cash if you need to, as a way to separate yourself from the competition further, and then just refinance later. And I think that's a huge advantage right now, because sellers are exhausted of the retrading and the lack of certainty behind execution on deals that have been tied up in this environment. Most sellers that are selling in this environment have to sell. They don't want to sell. So the last thing they want to do is get tied up for 6 months by somebody that can't close. In the fund structure, it just adds us an extra layer of heft to what we're able to offer to those sellers. So I think it puts us in a very good position to succeed and acquire assets that are typically reserved for larger institutional buyers. And also from a selfish standpoint, the fund environment is better for us because on the one-by-one deals we would do, we have about 325 investors in our platform. That number was pretty much stagnant for 18 months because I would bring a new deal out, the same people would invest in it, and I couldn't bring new people into our platform. And so I think what we're doing is pretty unique. I think we've got a very tech-forward platform that we're very transparent. Everything's digital. We are probably over-communicate with our investors. I'm sure you have some listeners that wish their operators or their sponsors communicated with them more. But you know, we do a lot to make sure everybody understands what's going on, including quarterly reporting, you know, monthly updates, and a full investor portal where they can access everything at once. So I think it's unique. I want more people to be able to participate in the things we're doing, not because I want to grow the platform, but because as someone that worked in the institutional real estate world, those Wall Street caliber deals have been reserved for the biggest investors in the world. Now we're starting to get to a point where the technology, the applications, the software has bled down to middle market type investors, even with institutional backgrounds. And so let's pay that forward to the smaller investor community and give them access to cooler deals.
Love it. Well, Dennis, if folks want to connect, if they want to learn more, what's the best way?
So the best way to learn more about Sentinel Opportunity Fund 1 is just sentinelopfund.com, or they can reach us via email at investors@sentinelnetlease.com.
Love it. Well, Dennis, love what you're doing, and thank you for the conversation. And for listeners at home, definitely connect with Dennis Cisterna at Sentinel Net Lease. The website is sentinelopfund.com. Link will be in the show notes. And in the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.